Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Pillar two of AUKUS, should we or shouldn't we? It is a simple question in an increasingly complicated and murky geopolitical environment. Tensions are high around the world. Massive armed conflicts are ongoing in Europe and in the Middle East. The two superpowers of our time, China and the USA, are seeing tensions between them ratcheting up. So how does New Zealand, an island of 5 million people in the Pacific, culturally closer to the West, economically much closer to China, how do we position ourselves? Well, Tim Grosser is a former National Party minister and diplomat. He also served as the ambassador to the United States from 2016 to 2018. And Tim Grosser joins me now. Kia ora.
Oh, kia ora. Thank you for the opportunity.
Let's start, perhaps, with the developments we saw in Iran over the weekend, in the Middle East, rather, over the weekend, Iran sending missiles and drones into Israel. The term World War III started trending online. People were incredibly shocked. And, does that mark an end to this benign strategic environment that we hear a lot about and that the world has supposedly enjoyed for some decades?
Frankly, Emil, I just can hardly believe what has happened in recent years to the overall strategic environment our small country of Aotearoa finds itself. You know, I spent all of my career, as, first of all, 35 years as a New Zealand negotiator and then 10 years as a politician, working in exactly what you described, this incredibly, well, by historical standards, benign environment, was with dreadful things going on in various regions during that period. But it allowed us to prosper, and it also allowed the most extraordinary process of poverty eradication around the world. You know, billions of people removed from absolute poverty. So, frankly, in a less than, I date it from 2015, which I think was the high point of what we call peak globalization. Since then, it's been a rapid downward spiral. I can hardly believe that we are facing now a war in Europe of major, major strategic proportions. Macron, the French president, I don't think he's wrong in describing it as posing an existential threat to Europe, and the possibility of a massive war in the Middle East consequent upon the issues that have just arisen in more recent weeks. Now, we all know the roots of these conflicts are very, very deep. And if we had a long time, I could give you a lovely intellectual explanation as to why the decision to expand NATO in 2008 to literal states of the Russians was probably a step too far, and all the screw-ups that have occurred since 1945 with respect to the foundation of Israel. But it doesn't alter the underlying reality that we're facing a situation which it is no longer implausible. I think it's unlikely, but not implausible, to see a scenario where nuclear weapons could be used.
Wow. It's fascinating to hear you say that, because we always focus on the here and now, and there is, I suppose, a danger of hyperbolizing and sort of exaggerating the danger that you're in at any sort of given point in time. But with all of your years and decades of experience, you point to now as being a particularly combustible international geopolitical point in time.
Absolutely. I think when you look at these events, you've got to, I'm sure there's a lovely technical term for it, but I can't find it in my head at the moment, where you're looking at events that have, if rationality prevails, low probability. Mm. But if they occur, maximum catastrophic impact. And of course, the ultimate example of that has got to be nuclear weapons. Mm. And I have always believed since the outbreak of, for me, it's a very interesting story because I was actually caught in Moscow during the first phase of this and literally detained by the Russian authorities because I was ordered quite correctly by the Prime Minister, John Key, to leave Moscow immediately and not sign a trade agreement with them that I'd been negotiating for a few years when they invaded Crimea. Mm. But that was never going to quite trigger the dangers that their confrontation into Western Ukraine. And I've always thought that if Russia were pressed to the point where they were facing complete humiliation, first the threat and then the possibility of use of tactical nuclear weapons could not be dismissed. Not a prediction it was going to happen, but it was a scenario that could not be dismissed. Now we have a situation in the Middle East where you could say from a different history, pretty much the same thing. Mm. I mean, as I read it, the underlying bigger picture is crystal clear. The Jewish people assumed that being citizens of Germany, Poland, and other European states, that their states would protect them. Mm. And they found out through the Holocaust this was incorrect. They then put massive pressure in the post-war environment to found an independent state that they could control. It was called Israel, and it involved a great deal of loss of Palestinian lands. And then when they had made that decision, they clearly made another decision, was they will never trust anybody else ever again to look after their security. They learned that in the Holocaust. Mm. So they developed a nuclear weapon capability, totally independent of the United States. They have believed to be between 400 and 800 nuclear weapons. Of course, they continue to deny, but nobody believes that this is correct. And I think that if they were ever faced with the existential question of the existence of their state, they would not hesitate to do the same thing. First threaten, ultimately use. So we are in a really bad space internationally, and we have to find some way of adjusting to that reality.
This is your assessment of sort of the broader geopolitical climate. Let's turn now to New Zealand's place within that, and I suppose how we are positioning ourselves. And the government is exploring the possibility of joining Pillar 2 of AUKUS. There are numerous countries that are considering the same. You have people like Helen Clark and the Labour leader Chris Hipkins saying this would mark an end to New Zealand's history of independent foreign policy. What's the appeal of joining Pillar 2 of AUKUS here?
First of all, I think we have to recognise that there are two different terms used, or two different meanings behind this phrase, independent foreign policy.
Sure.
There is a term that I thought was shared between the centre-left and the centre-right, which is this. We are not a non-aligned country. We generally identify ourselves, though not all New Zealanders would agree with this, with what is called politically and culturally the West. This is no longer a geographical expression. It is a more cultural expression, and it's broadly coterminous with the idea of democracies which follow a mixed model. Yeah. You can have a lot of variation on the approaches you take, but that's the broad unifying principle, and it's against autocracy on the other side. And I had thought that an independent foreign policy from that perspective would mean this. And I actually did write the paper for John Key when he became leader of the opposition and wanted to move decisively away from this fantasy apropos of rejoining ANZUS that would be gone by lunchtime. Mm. And it was this. We will make our own independent judgments, big issue by big issue, on where we think New Zealand's real long-term interests lie. And we will make that independently. It is probable that 90 to 95% of the time, we will come down with exactly the same position as if we were aligned rigidly to a Western position. Mm. But from time to time, we might not. That's what I think, though that's for people of my sort of centrist philosophy, think as an independent foreign policy. But historically, the term has been used by people much more extreme than that to put forward a view that we should actually essentially, well, historically become a member of the non-aligned movement if you go back to the politics of the 1960s and 70s. In other words, have nothing to do with the Five Eyes relationship, nothing to do with security arrangements with Australia and so on and so forth. So there are two very different meanings of this. Mm. Now, most certainly, if we were to join Pillar 2, and I think your listeners should think of this as, you know, AUKUS Lite, as in L-I-T-E.
Yeah.
Cooperation on certain matters with other parties that are not part of that massively militaristic concept of Pillar 1.
Yeah.
I think you've got to see yourselves as, would this actually mean the end of an independent foreign policy? If your understanding is mine, the answer is no. If your understanding is the more extreme version of this phrase, yes, it would, because it would absolutely involve some alignment with a structure that China has made it very clear they do not like. I believe that the current government, while the language that Mr. Peters and Minister Collins have used is their own and inevitably a little different to that used by Prime Minister Hipkins and his team when they were running the country. Mm-hmm. But essentially, the process is the same. Now, of course, I understand in opposition they're walking back on that. I don't want to make this into a partisan conversation. I can give you my interpretation of why they're doing this in terms of the two now avowedly left-wing parties well to the left of the Labour Party are eating their lunch. So I understand the pressures on Mr. Hipkins, but I do hope he preserves some margin of manoeuvre to allow him to recognise the longer-term interests of New Zealand are to maintain at least some options with respect to our most important relationship, which is not China, it is Australia.
You would have seen Helen Clark's remarks on this, that joining Pillar 2 risks too much of our relationship with China, which is vitally important economically, and it doesn't bring in enough benefits to justify that. I see the former Australian Foreign Minister, Bob Carsbin, even stronger today, saying Pillar 2 of AUKUS is, I think, science fiction bullshit, I think he said. You know, an American invention designed to lure nations into a strategic alliance against China. It's a very delicate position that we find ourselves in here.
Well, let me say, I think Bob Carr's statements are ridiculous, but I have and always have had a great deal of respect for Helen Clark and for her views. And I understand, given her historical role in the Labour movement and the large role she played in formulating the anti-nuclear policy, and I can understand where she is coming from. I have just said before, without any attempt to impugn her record, that I think she is overstating it. I think that what we're looking at is, first of all, we need to have interoperability with the Australian Defence Forces. When the decision was taken in 1904, I think it was, not to join the Federation, to extend it to the strategic sphere is to deny the statement geography is destiny. We have always had to consider our sovereignty and security in relationship to Australia. For a start-up, we've got 600,000 Kiwis living there, 75,000 New Zealand citizens left last year in the March year. And if we carry on at this rate, within a few years, there'll be more New Zealanders living in Australia than in the South Island. So we have got this overarching need to keep in touch, is the phrase I'd use, with Australia. And to be able, as successive governments have done for 70 years, to operate essentially under the leadership of the Australian armed forces, but while maintaining an autonomous and independent decision whether we want to do this. And once or twice we've said, no, we're not going with the Aussies on this one, that we have to maintain the technical capability to operate. Now, this Pillar 2 is really about technology. And if we lose touch with Australia and developments in the high technology area, often which have got dual use capabilities, you're ruling out a number of options for the future in a very uncertain future.
I suppose the pushback against that, you know, is that there's no point in having a good relationship with Australia if nobody in New Zealand has enough expendable cash to fly over there. You know, there's no point extolling the virtues of liberal democracy if you can't afford to keep your infrastructure up to spec. And if we alienated China economically through, you know, joining this AUKUS alliance, which they perceive, it doesn't really matter about the reality of it, does it? They perceive it as a big statement from the US to counteract the growing power of China. And if we alienated them economically, we are so reliant on them, we could be staring down the barrel of some seriously harsh stuff.
I'm the last person in the world in this sphere of activity to be an anti-China activist. I just about fell off the chair in Washington in the ambassador's office when I was there, when I read the 2017, what's called the NSS, the National Security Statement of the United States. This was under the Trump administration. And it said from memory, the objective of China is to undermine the security and prosperity of the United States. And I remember saying to the rest of the guys in the office, I said, that's not the objective of China. The objective of China is to increase their prosperity and their security. So I am not a China hawk. I understand why China has identified this as aimed at them, and I'm not going to pretend otherwise. But if we're going to be independent foreign policy, we've still got, we can't just say, oh, we can't do anything about this because the Chinese don't like it. We've got to find a way to do two things. One is to find out a way of keeping close to the more important country to us than China, irrespective of the shares of trade. I mean, China is our largest export market. Australia is our second. But also to de-risk the downside of such a relationship by quiet conversations with the Chinese that we are taking a pragmatic approach to this. We still value cooperation with China and a whole range of classic diplomatic tools at our disposal. I don't think the only way to maintain our trade is to have nothing to do with security, with Australia on security matters. I'm sorry.
I mean, Australia has a much more combustible relationship with China than we do. It seems as though you're saying that would be the benefit of joining up to AUKUS Pillar 2. Is actually, it's not about showing that we are good old mates with America. It's about solidifying the idea that Australia is our number one.
That's my bigger view of it. Yes. This is really about our relationship with Australia, not the United States.
And Australia is constantly getting into little squabbles and, you know, sometimes bigger squabbles with China. Indeed, I think Damien O'Connor got himself into a bit of hot water for suggesting that Australia could learn from the Kiwis when it comes to dealing with China. It's still going to potentially inflame our relationship with China, isn't it?
It's certainly not going to help.
Yeah.
But that is not for doing nothing about this and pretending it doesn't exist. Mm. So with respect to China, yes, they've had a much more combustible relationship, as you put it, with China. And the future of this is a little unclear.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that this strong anti-China policy that has influenced Australian policy but comes out of the United States is quite as robust as it might seem. I thought it was very intriguing that when the US Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen went there, I think it was last week, she was unequivocal in her statements that decoupling from China is not an option for the United States. I also noticed that the most important governor of the United States, which is by definition the governor of California, made an identical statement about 6 months ago when he called on President Xi. So, I mean, they can't deal with things like climate change without maintaining some sort of dialogue with China. So it went, I mean, we're a tiny player trying to find a way, as I put it in many speeches I've made on this, of riding the two horses in the circus at the same time, which requires a very delicate balancing act. We've got to do an even more delicate balancing act. We've got to keep in touch with the Aussies on this issue, in my opinion, which is why I think both the previous Labor government and the current government are correct in exploring a practical way to work on what I call AUKUS Lite, while at the same time exploring a range of diplomatic strategies designed to maintain a good working relationship with China. Not easy. That's what diplomats are meant to achieve.
Yes, I suppose it is, isn't it? Yeah. You've talked about your fear of serious conflict between great powers, which we're already seeing, you know, Ukraine and Russia, Iran and Israel potentially. Do you think, in your heart of hearts, when you step back and look at this, do you think the world internationally is actually potentially heading towards a serious confrontation between superpowers, between America and China, and perhaps New Zealand is starting to feel like it needs to pick a side?
In terms of probability, no. What I'm saying is that since predictions on the biggest issues in the world are always useless, you have to have a range of different scenarios in your mind and assign to them some crude order of probability. What you're talking about, the ultimate catastrophe, is not, I think, what is going to happen. But so tense are the issues around the two wars going on in the European continent, the Middle East region, and the very, very sharply deteriorating relationship over the last 5 years with China, acknowledging that there are very sensible voices in both China and the United States that want to pull back from this brink. These are not possibilities we can ignore. And therefore, when it comes to such a difficult policy issue as what sort of relationship do we want with AUKUS, this lovely word, optionality, goes to the forefront of my own personal thinking. I think we've got to be a little ambiguous about this. I think we've got to preserve options for a future New Zealand government. And I think having nothing to do with Pillar 2 is not the right way to give future governments optionality.
Tim Gross, a really interesting chat. Very grateful for you making time for us this evening.
Pleasure.
And that was Tim Grosser, a former National Party minister and a diplomat who also served as the ambassador to the United States from 2016 to 2018.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.